1964 in Racine at 8:10. The Morning Show with Greg Berg is next.
Welcome you to the Thursday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. We'll be hearing from thriller writer Grant Blackwood for most of the hour. Towards the end of the hour, a few words from a man who set foot on the moon on this date back in 1969, Buzz Aldrin. Here's part one. We're going to be talking today on the morning show about a new thriller, a really, really fine novel co-authored by two authors very, very well known for this kind of genre, Steve Barry and my morning show guest, Grant Blackwood. They have together co-authored The Ninth Man, a Luke Daniels thriller. And this is one of those thrillers that takes us all around the world and into a clandestine world that most of us know absolutely nothing about. It is done with an intriguing eye towards history and also with an eye towards writing about such remarkable events and characters with a heavy dose of bracing realism. It's what really makes a book like this especially compelling. I have really, really enjoyed The Ninth Man, which has just been published by Grand Central. And my morning show guest, Grant Blackwood, is a New York Times bestselling author many times over, author of the Briggs-Tanner series, co-author of the Fargo Adventure series with Clive Cussler, someone I've spoken to on this program, and co-author of the number one New York Times bestseller, Dead or Alive, with Tom Clancy. Grant Blackwood happens to himself be a U.S. Navy veteran, and we're going to spend a few minutes talking about some of his real-life experience that helps inform the way he writes books like The Ninth Man. Grant Blackwood, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thanks for having me, Greg. I appreciate it.
I am really, really excited to talk with you, and what a terrific book this is. Your biography says that you are a U.S. Navy veteran. I wonder if you could tell us a little bit more about the specifics of what you did, and I'm especially curious to know the carryover between that real-life experience and the kind of writing that you do on, for instance, The Ninth Man.
Sure. So I joined the Navy back during the Reagan-era 600-ship Navy. This was 1984. I was in for 3 years. I served aboard a guided missile frigate, the USS Ford. I was an operations specialist and a pilot rescue swimmer on that ship. And not long ago, they actually decommissioned that ship and sunk her to the bottom of the ocean. So it's been kind of a full circle. But I think when you're in the military, regardless of the service, you just kind of you get immersed in that world and the way people think and look at things. And I think being a thriller author from an early age, you combine that with some military service, and it's just it kind of threads its way through everything I do when I write, from the way I look at things and what I'm interested in. And it's been I've been at this for 36 years, and so it's just become part of my life.
Right. I want to get a little clarification on two things mentioned in your biography. One of them, you indeed did spend 3 years aboard a guided missile frigate as an operations specialist. Can you help us understand what that term means?
Sure. Operations specialist. Well, a guided missile frigate, its primary job was anti-submarine warfare, looking for subs on the edges of a battle group, for example, and trying to keep them away from the center of the battle group. And I was the operations specialist who worked in what was known then, and I don't know if they've changed it, but the Combat Information Center. And that's where all the data coming into the ship, from radar to sonar to fire control to electronic warfare, it's all comes in there and gets coordinated. And that is where you, quote unquote, fight the ship. So that's kind of what I did. I think things have changed a bit since I was in. But I think there is, I'm sure there's something similar aboard ships today.
And tell us about the other thing mentioned in your biography, that you were a pilot rescue swimmer. And tell us how that assignment came to you.
Well, it's every ship in the Navy needs to have at least, well, depending on the complement of the ship, but we need at least one pilot rescue swimmer. So primarily when you do what's known as plane guard duty off a carrier, when they're doing flight ops, you need to have not only airborne assets, they can go get pilots who have to bail or they ditch or whatever, but also there needs to be a ship nearby. And so I was asked to go to the school for pilot rescue swimmer training, and I went and I loved it, and I got assigned to be the ship's pilot rescue swimmer.
So it's not because you were a member of your high school swimming team or anything. It just it was an assignment that just kind of came to you, and you had to step up and fulfill it.
Well, you know, I always loved swimming. I swam quite a bit when I was in the Navy, and I was pretty fit. And they just asked me one day, and I went, and I loved it. The attrition rate for that school was pretty high, and I think they had had trouble getting, not trouble getting people to go, but trouble people finishing the class, the school. I think it was 50% washout rate. And so I took it and loved it, and that was the story.
So tell us how you ultimately found your way into this life as an author. And was that something that we would have seen coming? I mean, were there hints of this earlier in your life, that this might be your ultimate destiny? Or would it be, in a sense, for anyone who knew you and your full biography, would it be a surprise to you? Maybe was it even a surprise to us and to you as well?
No, when I was very young, I think I tried to write a couple of books, but I was too young to understand the concept. But I was about 18, and I was reading the Mediterranean paper by Clive Cussler. And I was transfixed and just taken away, and I'd lost my sense of time and space, and I realized that what a neat thing it would be to be able to write books that do the same thing for people. A few years later, I got out of the Navy, and it was summer of, I guess, 87, and I caught myself on a good day, because rather than saying someday I'll write, try to write a novel, I got a typewriter down from the closet, and I started, and it was 12 years to the day after I left the Navy that I got my first publishing deal.
Wow, very good. We're talking with Grant Blackwood, co-author of a new Luke Daniels thriller called The Ninth Man. He co-authored this book with Steve Barry. So something else about your biography that I notice is that not only have you been quite successful, but that some of your successes have been in the role of co-author with several different gentlemen with whom you have co-authored books. First of all, just talk in general about how that has come about, and generally speaking, how that works for you. And then, of course, I'm especially interested in how you co-authored The Ninth Man with Steve Barry.
Sure. So, you know, I didn't set out to be a co-author, but it's been a happy circumstance. Round about book four of the Briggs Tanner series, we couldn't come to an agreement about a deal, and so I was still at Putnam, and the editor said, you know, occasionally I have projects that come in, need an author, and would you be interested? I said, sure. And lo and behold, less than a year later, my editor called me, Tom Colgan is his name, and said, I've got this project for you, and I did a few ghostwriting things. And then one day he called out of the blue and said, how would you feel about co-authoring some books with Clive Cussler? And of course, you know, him being my mentor from afar, and the reason I got in the business, I jumped at it. And after that, opportunities came kind of fast and furious out there. There was Clive, then I worked with Tom Clancy, did a few books in his universe. Jim Rollins, I did a couple books with his Tucker Wayne series. And then a couple years ago, Steve and I got together. It's been a great experience. Not where I thought my career would go early on, but it's been a wonderful thing.
So, in general, how does it work? I mean, this matter of co-authoring a book, especially the matter of co-authoring a work of fiction. Somehow that seems even a little more complicated to me than co-authoring a book of nonfiction, where there is maybe certain areas of subject matter or whatever that you might divide between each other and then kind of check on each other's work. When one is creating a novel, how does that co-authorship process typically work?
Well, generally, I take my cues from my co-author. You know, all the names I've worked with, all the people I've worked with have been really pretty big names, and that's another reason I feel fortunate about it. But usually it's a matter of sitting down and chatting with them and seeing how they like to work. And that's, you know, kind of dovetailing my process with their process has kind of helped me become a really well-rounded writer. So it varies from author to author, but I tend to conform my myself to the way they like to work. Steve, who he and I have been friends for almost 20 years now, we have very similar sensibilities about thrillers and the point of thrillers. And we happen to think that thrillers are meant to be entertaining. That's why people pick them up. And so starting at that point, that became really our focus. But this is a deeply collaborative book. We went back and forth a lot until we got the product we wanted. And I think readers are going to love it.
So how much of this co-writing occurred with the two of you, in a sense, in the same room, or on the telephone or Zooming or whatever? I mean, has at least some of this co-writing been done in that kind of proximity? And are you writing the same passages together, or are you trading off and giving feedback to each other in what you're writing?
So the way it worked with Steve is we actually never wrote it in person. I mean, we've chatted in person, but the actual book wasn't written. I would send stuff back and forth. But from the genesis, when Steve called and said, you know, I've got this idea, I want to do Kennedy assassination, and here's my thought. He said, why don't you take it, run with it, we'll put together a sketch. And once we were happy with the sketch, I wrote the first draft. And this is, he explained, this is the way it's going to be, and I'm fine with it. So I wrote the first draft, and I sent it to him. Once we were happy with where draft was, Steve put his voice on it. This is a book primarily for Steve Barry's audience. And so Steve wanted to put his voice and his stamp on it. And so once he finished that part, we kind of threw it back and forth again until we were happy with it. But it was a lot of back and forth, a lot of what do you think of this and what do you think of that, and some things worked and some didn't, but it was a lot of back and forth, mainly by text and phone.
Right. So, and I don't mean this to be too personal a question, but why would a given author want to bring in somebody else to co-author a book? And in this case, for instance, how come Steve Barry just didn't write The Ninth Man completely on his own? Do you know very much about what prompted him to want to create this book in this fashion with you?
Yeah, we talked a lot about that. So Steve focuses on the Cotton Malone series. And it takes him a good, you know, from concept to finish, it takes him a good 18 months to write one. At any given time, he has 300 or 400 sources he's consulting, because his books are heavily influenced by history. And so when he went to Grand Central and said, we want to do a spinoff with Luke Daniels, who appears in the Cotton Malone series, they said, yeah, let's do it. But he knew he just didn't have the time to do it. And us being friends and him liking my work and I'm liking his, we thought it was a good match. And so it's not just logistics, but I think we're a good team to write this kind of book.
Well, evidently, because the book is absolutely terrific. And for those of you just joining us, I'm speaking today on The Morning Show with Grant Blackwood, a best-selling author many times over, co-author with Steve Barry of a brand-new book called The Ninth Man, a Luke Daniels thriller. And Luke Daniels, a character who has appeared in the Cotton Malone novels, and in a sense, leading man now, the focus of this really, really intriguing thriller. Before we get to specifically the character of Luke Daniels and some of the other really interesting characters that populate this book, tell us, Grant Blackwood, a little bit about what you said earlier, that a thriller needs to be entertaining. I mean, that's why you write a book like this. That's why people read a book like this. Tell us more about how you like thrillers to be shaped and what are some of the guiding principles that are really important for you to remember.
Sure. It's, you know, there are a lot of subgenres within the thriller genre, but in the end, readers pick these up because they want to be entertained. Now, if they come away having been educated or provoked or enlightened, all the better. But if you're failing to meet that entertainment, what I think of it as the tip of the arrow, if you fail to meet that criteria, there's really no good reason to pick up the book. There are a lot of things that go into an entertaining thriller, larger-than-life characters, exotic settings, often globetrotting, multiple points of view, high concept stuff where readers are not going to encounter this kind of thing in their everyday lives. So there's a lot that goes into it, and which explains why it takes so long to get good at this kind of thing. But yeah, if you keep in mind entertain, then you're in good shape.
So tell us more about this central character in The Ninth Man, specifically Luke Daniels, an agent with a group called Magellan Belay. Tell us more about Luke Daniels, his background, and this work that he does as the novel begins.
Sure. So Luke Daniels appeared in Steve's Lincoln Myth for the first time. And Luke came out of the Army. He was an Army Ranger. Came out of the Army and asked his uncle, who happens to be Danny Daniels, the President of the United States, you know, can you point me in the right direction? And so Luke got hooked up with Magellan Billet, where Cotton Malone works, and kind of got a tryout there, and he did well, and he appeared again. So, you know, Luke, at the start of his appearance at Lincoln Myth, he is this hard-charging, kind of sassy, irreverent guy who thinks action is the solution to all problems. Cotton Malone is a little bit different. He's a little more mature, seasoned. And so this is a Luke that you get at the start of The Ninth Man. He's still a bit impetuous, still wants to mix it up, and he thinks, you know, getting mixed up, hands-on kind of stuff is the way to solve everything. But he grows throughout the course of this book. In the beginning of The Ninth Man, he is in Europe, and he gets a phone call from an old friend, a good friend, who is in trouble, and that's how he gets mixed up in all this.
At one point, in a really tense moment, you have Luke Daniels thinking to himself, what was the Ranger way? When in doubt, act. That's probably a pretty good summary of what you were just saying in terms of the impetuousness of Luke Daniels, but also the fact that sometimes when you are in a situation of especially grave peril, that's maybe what has to happen. When in doubt, act.
Yeah, I mean, if that in all kinds of situations, whether it's personal self-defense or in the military, you know, there's this period called the freeze when people can't believe something terrible is happening to them. And Rangers, among many other soldiers and special forces operators, they're kind of trained, don't sit still, don't freeze, act. And Rangers are very good at direct action and immediate quick response. And this is kind of ingrained in Luke, take action.
Right. When we first see him and he is responding to this call for help from his former acquaintance, Jillian Greenfield Stein, a former Marine, he comes to the place where he thinks she is and observes a total of five sinister-looking men outside of the house and apparently about to attack. And our narrator says the odds were stacked, five of them, the odds were stacked, but the hard way was like candy to a Ranger. which is an interesting thought about how somebody who engages in this kind of work, in a sense, relishes opportunities like this where the situation is especially dangerous and the odds are stacked against them.
Yeah, and that's, you know, they run to danger and they do it in a well-trained, disciplined way. But these are the people you call when really tough things need to get done. And Rangers are especially good at getting these really tough missions done.
So tell us about the character of Jillian Greenfield Stein. And first of all, is this a character that has been seen in other novels before this, or is she making her initial appearance in The Ninth Man?
So Jillian appears for the first time in this book. Jillian is a former Marine. She really broke some glass ceilings in the world of combat Marines as a woman. So she's well-trained. She's tough-minded. She's sassy. She gives as good as she gets with Luke. But in the beginning, her skills are kind of a little rusty. So throughout the book, what was a good friendship, slightly romantic situation, they become a formidable team. And once she gets her skills back online, she and Luke are tough to beat.
Hmm. Tell us the reason why she finds herself in such danger.
So Jillian makes, and I'm going to be a bit vague here so readers will be tantalized, but
yep.
Jillian makes a mistake. She reaches out to contact someone she shouldn't have contacted. She's in a grieving situation with her grandfather, who is gravely ill, and she reaches out and makes contact with somebody she shouldn't have touched base with, and this starts this domino effect of terrible things. And when she realizes what she's done, she calls Luke and says, help. He's the guy that was first in her mind to call.
Is it saying too much to say what happens to her grandfather early in the novel?
No, I don't think so. I mean, he doesn't fare well. He dies shortly after Luke gets there, and that is a whole other tale unto itself that readers will learn about as they go along. But yeah, he doesn't make it.
And of course, what is especially ominous about this is that, as we've already said, he was dying, terminal cancer. I mean, he did not have long to live, and yet somebody feels the need to end his life. Rather than just letting this terrible cancer run its course. And that points to something especially dangerous. And, of course, his granddaughter is drawn into that very same danger.
And that's the weight of the secret that Benjamin Stein carried and passed along to not only Jillian, his granddaughter, but Luke as well. It is such an explosive secret that the people arrayed against Luke and Jillian are not willing to take it for granted that Benjamin will die with the secret.
Right. And this is somebody who has been carrying the secret for quite some time, and in a sense, it ultimately destroyed him. And it takes us a long time before we finally uncover just what the nature of this secret is. So very early in the novel, we also meet, in a sense, the other major figure in this novel, someone who is a much more mysterious figure. I warm up to him for a moment because he proves to be a classical music fan, as I am, and an opera fan, as I am, listening to Wagner's Götterdämmerung, Twilight of the Gods, as we first meet Thomas Rowland. But very quickly, we learn that this is not somebody we should be admiring at all. Tell us more about this character and maybe a bit about how you and Steve Barry shaped him and the specifics of who he is.
So Thomas Rowland is, and Steve puts it best, I think, Thomas Rowland is an amoral sociopath. Thomas Rowland works deep in the government, or did. He's officially retired now. But he is the kind of power broker behind the scenes that you never hear his name. And if you do hear his name, it's probably because you're in deep trouble and you're not long for this earth. He has so many secrets and knows so many secrets and has pulled so many strings that there's really nowhere his influence can't extend. And in this case, he has drawn Luke and Jillian has they've drawn his attention, which is not a great thing. But he's formidable and has formidable people at his fingertips. And he has no boundaries about morality or legality or anything like that. And that's who they're up against.
Right. Someone who works for him, one Jack Talley, you at one point have him thinking or realizing that that Thomas Rowland was totally and completely amoral. The man had no conscience nor any value system to violate. Literally anything and everything was on the table. Nothing was off limits, not even murder. I'm trying to find it. I made a note about something really intriguing about him, namely that that the way he kind of conducted so much of his life was about the accumulation of favors, and that in a sense so much of his life and how he did what he did was wrapped up in this accumulation of. Yeah, he proved to be, here I found it, an expert in accumulating favors. Explain to our listeners what's behind those intriguing words.
Well, everybody has their, you know, skeletons in their closet. Everybody can be leveraged. And I think Thomas Rowland is a guy that knows that true power comes from leverage. And so he has found out the terrible secrets of a whole lot of people, large and small, enough to get them to do his bidding. And kind of that's how he's done it. And he's been in government and in the dark recesses of government and espionage for decades upon decades. And so that's just how he leverages people into power and getting what he wants. Plus, he has people that will do his nastiness for him on the ground if he finds someone who won't play his game.
At one point in the book, you have a distinction being made that I think is really intriguing and worth talking about. And let me see if I can lay my hands on the exact moment. Yes, here we go. And I'm not sure at this point if it's just exactly who, if it's Luke Daniels or if it's Jillian Stein who's thinking here. But anyway, they are thinking to themselves, they weren't spies. They were intelligence officers, field agents, eyes and ears on the ground, there to investigate, analyze, and report. Only if a field officer began to operate clandestinely with the enemy, interacting, subject to arrest, detention, even torture or death, did they become a spy. Tell us more about this distinction and why you and your co-author thought it was important to take the time to spell out that distinction for us between spies and intelligence officers.
So, you know, the primary difference is CIA case officers are the kind of people who go out and recruit other people to betray their country, essentially. And that person becomes, there's a variety of subtitles you can give them, but that person then who has agreed to betray their own country, they become an agent. They are, in effect, a spy. So case officers are the people that are the puppet masters, and they go out and find these people to turn over the secrets of their country to ours. Intelligence operatives are often paramilitary people that go in and they do the dicier kind of hands-on stuff that you see in the shadows and you often see in Hollywood. But the case officers are CIA case officers are the people that recruit spies, essentially.
Another intriguing character in this thriller that we've not yet talked about is one Jack Talley, who works for Thomas Rowland. His presence is significant in this novel, and partly because of who he is by this point in his life. Tell us whatever you want our listeners to know about one Jack Talley.
So Jack Talley is a former Delta Force, Army Delta Force operative, and he and Luke have a very close history. They had a close encounter in Afghanistan, and readers can read about that in the book, but they have a history. And so when they encounter each other, not only do they know each other, but they ostensibly live by a similar code. But Jack, for the betterment of his family, has kind of sold his soul to Thomas Rowland, and he's become the evil that he would have once decried. And so he does these bad things for Jack Talley. But throughout the novel, Thomas Rowland, but throughout the novel, you can see that partially because of Luke's words and actions and the way Luke moves through his life, Jack begins to second guess the choices he has made. And the reader at the end, I think, gets to see how this impacts Jack and what he does.
Right. There's a great line at one point in reference to this Jack Talley. Funny how money had a way of silencing one's own conscience. And that is what has, in effect, happened with Jack Talley.
It has. And thanks to Luke, Jack Talley, I think, finds his conscience in the end.
And I want to ask you about something specific, and this is from that the moment in the novel when Jack Talley and Luke Daniels are actually confronting each other face to face for the first time in the novel. I mean, they'd had that earlier encounter, and at one point, Luke Daniels begins to quote to Jack Talley the Army Special Forces motto, De oppresso liber, to free the oppressed. Is this actually the Army Special Forces motto, or is this something that you and your co-author created out of your own imagination? Either way, it's really quite striking.
It is. No, it's out there. You know, each branch kind of has their, well, that's really their credo. Each branch kind of has their own motto and sayings that encapsulate who they are. But that is the credo for a lot of special forces operatives. And Luke is reciting this to Jack to remind him who he once was and the choices that Jack has made, that has brought him to this place. And I think Luke is just trying to shake him
right
back to his original self.
Right. To free the oppressed, I pledge to uphold the honor and integrity of their legacy in all that I am, in all that I do. I will not fail those with whom I serve. I will not bring shame upon myself or special forces. And yes, this is a very uncomfortable moment for Jack Talley. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
It is. And the interesting thing about that is Luke never outwardly just accuses him of breaking that. He doesn't need to say to Jack, you've done wrong, you've gone astray. Simply reciting these words to a soldier, especially, say, a Delta Force soldier, that's enough of the impact just to hear those words in your ears again. Mm.
I want to ask you about a couple of specific moments in the novel that are not, in a sense, all that significant to what ultimately unfolds. They're just wonderful details that could not possibly have been written by someone without, you know, kind of the knowledge and know-how that you and your co-author have. I'm thinking, for instance, of the very first scene in the book where Luke Daniels is coming to the aid of Jillian Stein, and we kind of mentioned this scene already where he ultimately counts five guys who are converging on this home. And one of them, the first one that he sees, drives up in a van, gets out, and then begins whistling. And he's whistling in a way that's not just kind of quietly to himself, but whistling outwardly a little more loudly than one probably would under these circumstances. And for a very specific purpose. Explain to our listeners what this whistling is about. And if this is something that is kind of well known in the lore of special agents.
Well, you know, one of the things you don't want when you're doing something that is ostensibly covert is you don't want undue attention. And one of the most annoying bits of undue attention are dogs that bark, because barking dogs wake up their owners, especially owners who know the different kind of barks of their dogs. And so this person is trying to capture the attention of nearby dogs to see what kind of attention they might draw if things get ugly. And so that's what he is up to.
Hmm. I found that just absolutely fascinating. There's also, there's actually several really exciting chase scenes in the book. And there's one in which Luke Daniels, I think, is behind the wheel, and he finds himself needing to just crash right through basically a fence in a field. And as this moment is kind of being narrated, we're told Luke Daniels knew that fences were all different, and seldom did they react to a collision as Hollywood portrayed, lying flat the instant a bumper touched them. I thought that was just really great because, of course, I think the average person trying to write a book like this would probably fall back on the things they've seen happen in countless movies. And you've tried to construct this moment with a little more reality in the mix. Tell us more about the nature of fences and for instance, you know, where you even kind of learned that fences can be very unpredictable in circumstances like this.
You know, I think the starting point really is a belief in Murphy's Law. Luke Daniels is not a huge, he doesn't buy deeply into Murphy's Law, which says that anything that can go wrong will go wrong. But as thriller authors and somebody that's, you know, kind of immersed in the military world, you're always looking for that worst case scenario. So when I'm writing things, what you're looking for is, what can I make go wrong? How can I make this character's life worse? And so I started thinking about this fence. What might it react? And the idea that a fence like that, it's a big hurricane fence with the steel triangle mesh. Everybody's seen them. And it's pretty tall, and it's the posts are cemented in the ground. I thought, well, you know, it might flatten, but what if it doesn't? What if that big hurricane fence doesn't fall all at once? And some of the metal netting becomes something of a trap for the car. And so the more I played with it, the more I realized it's quite plausible that fences behave erratically and chaotically, and they become a lot more of a problem, which is, you know, for thriller writers, that's what we want. We want problem after problem after problem facing our protagonists.
Absolutely. And we like the peril and troubles and complications to pile up, and they certainly do in really interesting fashion. At one point, this kind of goes back to Jillian Stein's misstep that, at least in a sense, led to the killing of her beloved grandfather. In trying to kind of get to the bottom of this mysterious email address which she had utilized and looking for some information, something's mentioned called a Google whack. I'd never heard of this. Is this a real thing? And I'd love you to explain it to our listeners.
It's been a while since I Google whacked, but a Google whack is a game you can play on Google, and what you're looking for is, you can set various parameters, but what you're looking for is putting in a search term of various links that produce one hit or no hits, or, you know, seven hits. You set your own criteria, but knowing how big Google is and how quickly it finds things, finding a Google whack is a unicorn event. And that's kind of what I'm talking about when I discuss that.
Right. So you have Luke Daniels reaching out to a tech expert who actually, I think, works for Magellan Belay, but this is something sort of off the clock that he's searching for success. And I just think this is such a great example of what sets apart a book like this from maybe more run-of-the-mill thrillers, because this tech expert that Luke Daniels calls up, Marsha Pooler, is herself a fascinating character, wonderfully constructed, really out of the ordinary. Just say a quick word about this character, who does not figure all that prominently in the novel, but it just gives it a wonderful little extra bit of texture.
So Marsha Pooler is an older lady who really was not technically savvy for most of her life. And after taking a small class on computer literacy, she found she had been her whole life without realizing it, a computer savant. And she plunges into this world of not just computers, but, you know, digital access and cybersecurity and all this. And she finds that she not only loves it, but she's very adept, which is not something you see a lot because the younger generation is immersed in it. But the older generation, like myself, you got to work at it. But Marsha is a prodigy, and she is an interesting character.
Absolutely. A last quick question. We haven't yet really touched on the whole matter, but you yourself mentioned it, that this novel and the events that are swirling around Luke Daniels and Gillian Stein have something to do with the assassination of John F. Kennedy 60 years ago, as this novel is published. Tell our listeners whatever you want them to know at this point about that connection with that tragedy back in 1963.
Yeah, so we're at the 60th anniversary of the Kennedy assassination this year. And it is, you know, Steve calls it a seminal event in American history, and I agree. But I also think of it as the greatest solved, unsolved mystery in American history. Because someone's been named and a lot of fingers have been pointed. There's evidence that goes in a whole lot of different ways. But Steve wanted to do something with Kennedy for a long time, and it just didn't fit with the Cotton Malone books. But here comes Luke Daniels, a hard-charging action guy, and it was a good fit. And the question became, you know, all the people from the Kennedy assassination are pretty much dead. What would it look like, was the essential question, what would it look like for somebody today to actually successfully unravel the quote-unquote truth behind that assassination? What happened that day? Who killed Kennedy and why and how? And how did it look on the ground in Dallas 60 years ago? And that's the genesis of the story. But that was, you know, the Kennedy assassination is really the first video-recorded assassination in human history. Now it's very common. But back then, the Zapruder film, which captured it in all its ugly glory, it was a revelation to be able to see that. And that's why it's such a huge event in American history.
Right. And of course, ultimately, it figures in a very central way in the swirl of danger that surrounds Luke Daniels and Gillian Stein. And by the way, I just love the fact that Luke Daniels was named Luke because his mother was deeply religious, and his three brothers are Matthew, Mark, and John. And it's just kind of interesting to think about that mother naming her four sons after the four apostles, and yes, imagining the kind of life which ensued for her son, a life I'm sure she could never have in her wildest dreams imagined.
Well, Luke is a good old Southern boy, and he calls his mama every Sunday. Rain or shine and gunfire or peace, he does it. So,
might there be more books co-authored by you and Steve Barry?
Yeah, currently there are three Luke Daniels thrillers planned. We're putting to bed book two right now, and I recently was with Steve and Ford on tour. And we've got a solid idea for book three, and we hope it continues. But we really think readers are going to enjoy Luke Daniels.
Fantastic. Well, I certainly did. And this new novel is titled The Ninth Man. It is published by Grand Central Press, co-authored by Steve Barry and my morning show guest, Grant Blackwood. Grant Blackwood, congratulations on an absolutely terrific thriller. It is one of those books that you just can't put down. You can scarcely turn the pages fast enough. And I really am excited to see what other books follow in its wake. And I really appreciate you taking the time to be my morning show guest today. Thank you so much.
Thanks,
and best
Greg.
Wishes.
You're a pro, Greg. I appreciate it.
You're listening to the Thursday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. It was on this date, the 20th of July, 1969, that Neil Armstrong and Buzz Aldrin set foot on the moon. I thought in honor of that anniversary, I would replay a portion of this memorable morning show conversation I was privileged to record back in 2013. Well, in a quarter century of doing this program, I can't think of a more thrilling moment than to say these words. My morning show guest is Buzz Aldrin, NASA astronaut, the second man to walk on the moon, and really a visionary thinker when it comes to a humankind's place in space and the next step that the United States should take in reasserting itself in space. And Buzz Aldrin lays out his vision in a fascinating book published by National Geographic called Mission to Mars, My Vision for Space Exploration, in which he recalls his experiences of walking upon the moon as one of the astronauts of Apollo 11, and also speaks in great detail about what he hopes and dreams might be in our future in terms of space exploration. Mr. Aldrin, we welcome you to the morning show.
Well, thank you very, very much. Your last 25 years of broadcasting, just think the next 25 years, we will be on the surface of Mars permanently.
We'll have something very exciting to talk about then. Very much so. One of the most intriguing phrases in the book is when you talk about how we need to create, in your words, a permanent and profitable presence in space. And particularly when we talk about perhaps reaching the planet Mars, you want us to be permanently on Mars, and you want ultimately all of this to be somehow profitable. Explain how such a thing could be possible.
Well, commercial transport will be shortly taking astronauts to the space station. They're subsidized some by the government, but they are doing it cheaper than the space shuttle or Orion could do. And my plan is to establish a commercial space station starting out as early as 2018, in the same vicinity of the Chinese space station, and then beginning to build space stations on opposite sides of the moon, where we can augment those and establish competitive commercial crew and cargo delivery of the controllers at the vicinity of the moon that'll be controlling things on the surface for all nations. And since the number of people needed there will not be that great, the transportation commercially available to locations close to the moon and perhaps on the moon can be done commercially for private citizens and marketed commercially for a profit. Mm. Now, that's not going to be things that can be sold by lotteries. I used to think of that, but there are better ways. But commercial activities can build upon the designs of Mars landers to use on the moon for commercial, for other countries that can't quite come up to that, South Korea, India, United Arab Emirates, where they can help financing the other nations in the building of some of these habitats following a U.S. design or improved, and then they manufacture and then internationally land these things. The U.S. can't do all of the things that are necessary, and we need to lead and help to manage activities worldwide in support of historical establishment of permanence on another planet, which will be remembered for hundreds and thousands of years as a legacy in the future.
Just as that accomplishment is remembered of you and Neil Armstrong and the astronauts who followed walking on the moon. Your book, again, from National Geographic is called Mission to Mars, My Vision for Space Exploration. Buzz Aldrin, thank you so much for joining me today on The Morning Show. Very best wishes to you.
Thank you very much. Bye-bye.
Again, that interview with Buzz Aldrin was actually recorded 10 years ago. Tomorrow on The Morning Show, Dr. Art Sear joins us for his monthly visit to The Morning Show to offer his reflection and commentary on an array of current events and issues. That's tomorrow, the